I'm Alistair Madden, and you're listening to Season 5, Episode 3 of the Road to Nowhere European Football Podcast. In this episode, we discussed Bologna's Scottish heartbeat, we unpacked Villarreal's volcanic post-Emery atmosphere, we spoke about Laurent Blanc's fatal dogmatism, and we put Stuttgart's Seru Girassi-inspired goal rush under the Road to Nowhere microscope. We looked at all of those topics and so much more in our usual detailed way. Do go and check out the show notes for a comprehensive running order. As always, this episode is produced in partnership with Freelance Football Ops. If any of our listeners are freelancing in football, you may be interested in signing up to Freelance Football Ops subscription-based newsletter. They find jobs which cover writing, design, video, audio, and generally anything in football media every week. For more info, visit freelancefootballops.com or follow at FFOps on Twitter. Right, on now with the episode. Hopefully you're all staying safe. Hopefully you're all staying well. Thanks, as always, for your continued support. Enjoy. I'm back from a week in the Welsh countryside, a thoroughly relaxing week. The batteries have been recharged. I'm feeling revitalised and we're ready to go for another episode of the Road to Nowhere podcast. I'm with Rudy Barlow and we will shortly be joined by Michael Jones. In the meantime, Rudy Barlow, how are you doing?
Yep, we're back. It has to be said, we had a reasonably kind of chill international break. I mean, Spain was too busy having its own scandals, as it generally does, but it's good to be back. The Champions League is back, Europa League is back, Conference League is back. So there's games galore, there's football every which way you look. And I have to be said, I'm tired, but I'm quite enjoying it so far. Ask me that again by the next international break, you might get a different answer.
Good stuff, Barlow, good stuff. And I see that you are sporting your Scotland top. I'm tapping my forehead at the moment. Touch wood that Scotland are within touching distance of confirming their place in Germany next summer for Euro 2024. I've already booked my flights across to Dusseldorf and Köln for 2 weeks over there. So that will be quite something. And it will be even better should Scotland secure their place in the tournament next summer. So yeah, we'll keep our fingers crossed that they can do that. But yes, we are here to talk about domestic football. I've touched there on Germany, and I think the Bundesliga is a great place for us to start in this episode, Barlow.
Yep, we'll head straight to Germany, where Stuttgart flirted excessively with relegation in both of the two previous Bundesliga campaigns, notably relying on a two-legged playoff victory over Hamburg back in June to preserve their top-flight status. Looking at their start to the current season, however, they've scored 10 times in their opening two home fixtures, with Seru Girassi responsible for almost half of those goals. Led by Sebastian Hoeneß, the five times champions of Germany have lit up the region of Baden-Württemberg with their swashbuckling performances at the MHPA Arena. What have been the main takeaways from those early season home triumphs? And is the club's southwestern goal rush in any way sustainable, Ali?
Yeah, Barlow, I think Stuttgart have surprised quite a lot of people at the start of this season, and there's probably not a single player in Europe right now oozing more confidence than Stuttgart's 27-year-old 6'2" striker, Seru Girassi. Now, perhaps only a certain Jude Bellingham could give him a run for his money. Girassi's confidence, for me anyway, has to be the main talking point when unpacking Stuttgart's free-scoring start to the season. Now, you focused in your framing of the question on the home games, and there's good reason for that, but they actually started picking up some goals away from home as well, and away at Mainz on match day 4, Girassi scored a perfect hat-trick, dinking one over the keeper with his right foot, slotting one in at the near post with his left foot after some good movement, and then nodding the ball into the net to round off his afternoon's work. If you haven't already seen his hat-trick, it's quite something, particularly the second goal. So smooth is the way he just jinxes through the box and, yeah, slides the ball past the goalkeeper. Now, you might have seen Opta tweet this. Opta seemed quite omnipresent on Twitter or X these days, but that hat-trick took Girassi to an astonishing 8 goals in the opening 4 Bundesliga matches. No player has actually scored as many goals as that in the first 4 match days of a Bundesliga season since Peter Meyer's record of 9 for Borussia Mönchengladbach back in the late 1960s. So for wider context, Guirassy has picked up from where he left off last season when he, of course, scored 4 in his last 5 league games and won in the relegation playoff against Hamburg to help keep VfB in the Bundesliga. In terms of Guirassy's playing style, there was a good article by Matt Pearson for the DW website, which succinctly described Guirassy as tall, strong and mobile enough to play as a lone frontman and assured enough on the ball to operate as one of a front two or three. The official Bundesliga website says he has a powerful presence in the air, boasts good close control and is capable of playing out wide to add to his team's options. Just looking briefly at his underlying numbers, there's not a huge amount of green on his FBE ref scout report, but perhaps most importantly, he does sit in the 89th percentile for non-penalty expected goals when compared to his positional peers across Europe's top 5 leagues. And certainly based on his form with Stuttgart, he's more than passing the eye test. Now, just thinking about his career generally, Barley spent his early days playing for Laval, Lille and Auxerre on loan before his first Bundesliga move to Köln back in 2016. And that move never really worked out for him. He did score, if I'm remembering correctly, against Arsenal in the Europa League. But on the whole, it wasn't the most positive of spells for Guirassy in Germany. So he moved back to France on loan to Amiens in 2019. And then again, signed permanent with Amiens after a fairly successful initial loan spell. So he showed enough promise at Amiens for Rennes to then decide to fork out €15 million in 2020. And when he was at Rennes, he averaged just under a goal every 3 games. So that's a decent, if unspectacular, return. And that's where Stuttgart and subsequently Sebastian Hoeneß come in. So in 33 games for Stuttgart, Guirassy has scored 23 times. So in that respect, at 27, I think there is absolutely an argument to be made that Guirassy is the quintessential late bloomer, and it does feel like he has finally found somewhere to call home following his move to Baden-Württemberg. He's really thriving in that role, spearheading Stuttgart's attack, and you can tell he's really enjoying his football. One point I would make is that it will be interesting to see how the team adapts in January when they lose Guirassy to international duty. He'll be heading out to the Ivory Coast to represent Guinea at the African Cup of Nations after he opted last year to represent the country in which his parents were born. He'd represented France at youth level, for what it's worth. In any event, with his goals and, yeah, really quite selfless attitude, which really comes across in his post-match interviews, I think Guirassy is well on his way to becoming Stuttgart's latest cult hero forward. It does feel, when I say that, like I'm cheating on former Road to Nowhere favourite Sasha Kalajic by saying that, but it's true. He's a great forward, a really likeable forward, and yeah, just something different about the way that he plays his game. Thinking now about the second part of your question, Barlow, it does go without saying that Stuttgart probably won't score 5 goals every home game this season. They've registered 3 expected goals and 1.7 expected goals in the 5-goal home wins over Bochum and Freiburg respectively, but they do sit 4th in the table for non-penalty expected goals and 2nd in the table for non-penalty XG per shot. So whilst they're creating plenty of high quality chances, the underlying numbers do confirm that we probably won't be seeing Hoeneß's side score as many as 5 goals in every home game this season. We'll probably still see them score goals and a decent number of goals at that, but yeah, I don't think we'll be seeing them score 5 goals every home game, although it probably wouldn't have taken a rocket scientist to have worked that one out. That said, the early signs do suggest that Stuttgart are going to be a lot of fun to watch this season under Sebastian Hoeneß. Hoeneß himself is an interesting figure, and I do just want to briefly spotlight his background. His father is Dieter Hoeneß, who played as a striker for the likes of Stuttgart, Bayern and Germany, and his uncle is perhaps more well known. His uncle is Uli Hoeneß, who of course played in the great Bayern team in the 1970s and won Euro 1972 and the 1974 World Cup with Germany before going on to become Bayern's general manager and president. So yeah, quite an illustrious family there for Sebastian Hoeneß. In terms of Sebastian's own playing career, he played for the youth teams at Stuttgart before spending time with Hertha Berlin's reserves and briefly with Hoffenheim. He then made the move into youth team management back in 2011 when he was just 29, it seems like quite a well-trodden path for players who, yeah, either get injured or who have very unremarkable playing careers to make an early move into management. We've seen it, yeah, with several high-profile German managers throughout Europe now. But anyway, over 8 years, he earned his stripes and worked his way up to the Bayern Munich reserves job in 2019, with his side becoming the first reserve team in history, actually, to win Germany's third division. You might remember that at the time. They certainly caught the eye, and that got Hoeneß into the mainstream conversation. And that triumph in particular caught Hoffenheim's eye, with the club appointing him as their new manager in August 2020. When he was in charge of Hoffenheim, Barlow, there were flickers of real promise before it all ended in rather underwhelming fashion. Now, in mid-March last year, I think it was mid-March, I remember his Hoffenheim side drew 1-1 with Bayern Munich at the Rhein-Neckar Arena, and that brought them within a point of third place with 8 games to go. And you thought, yeah, Champions League football, it's a real possibility, but they crashed and burned and picked up just 2 points across those last 8 games and ultimately finished in 9th place. So that did feel like a sort of sliding doors moment for Hoeneß. Maybe it was a blessing in disguise, because it gave him the opportunity to take some time away to refine his managerial skill set and come back ultimately a better and more mature manager. At Stuttgart, he's tended to go with either a 3-4-2-1 formation or a 4-2-3-1, and he isn't half getting results. Now, when he took over in April, earlier this year, the club was rooted to the bottom of the table, but he stopped the rot, he turned things around, and he kept them up via the relegation playoffs. He's overseen 10 wins and just 3 defeats in all competitions across his first 17 games in charge, averaging 2 points per game, and that is a mightily impressive record when you consider the state of the club prior to Hoeneß's arrival. You do feel, just to reiterate, I suppose, that Hoeneß is blossoming into a seriously good manager, and that he's learned from his time at Hoffenheim. He's used 8-9 months or so away from the dugout to really, yeah, refine his managerial skill set. And Stuttgart, yeah, they are reaping the rewards.
Interesting stuff, Ali. Fascinating to hear about kind of Stuttgart, who perhaps aren't one of the more heralded names in the Bundesliga, but they always seem to be there or thereabouts, and there's always an interesting narrative surrounding them. But in between those two convincing home wins, Stuttgart did suffer a heavy 5-1 defeat away to RB Leipzig. Marco Rose's side made some intriguing summer signings, with Xavi Simons, Lois Openda and Benjamin Sesko arriving from PSG, Lens and RB Salzburg, respectively. The three forward players have bagged 8 goals between them across the opening 4 fixtures of the new Bundesliga campaign, providing the club with plenty of cause for cautious optimism. Could we perhaps make the argument that Leipzig boasts one of the league's most exciting attacks, Alan?
Yeah, Barlow, I think we could quite comfortably make such an argument. And I do just want to spotlight those three summer signings you referenced. Now, Openda is 23, Xavi is 20, and Sesko is 20. So, yeah, some promising young talents, to put it one way. We raved about Lois Openda on the podcast when he was at Lens. Xavi Simons has for a while been regarded as one of the most exciting young players in Europe, and Benjamin Sesko has just bagged 16 goals in the top flight of Austrian football. So yeah, on paper, those signings really seemed like clever bits of business. That said, I don't think anybody could have envisaged that all three would have hit the ground running quite as emphatically as they have done, particularly Openda and Xavi. Now, Leipzig set themselves up in a nominal 4-2-2-2 formation, I suppose we could say, and Openda has been deployed as one of the front two, and Xavi typically operates in that sort of second line of attack on the right-hand side. Sesko himself, he's been coming off the bench for the final 15 minutes or so of most games and making a real impact, particularly in the win away to Union Berlin. The real standout for me, Barlow, has been Xavi. He's so good on and off the ball, he interprets space well, he's always looking to create, to do something positive, and he's got a wicked shot in his repertoire. We saw, for example, his goal against Union Berlin, absolutely beautiful strike. Do go and check that out if you've not already seen it. But as well as his unquestionable technical ability and his increasingly refined end product, he does have this real tenacious side with a real engine on him. So no Leipzig player, actually, for what it's worth, has registered more sprints or intensive runs than Xavi. And I think, yeah, that blend of technique and tenacity bodes extremely well for his overall development. I think it was actually quite telling when Marco Rose said that Xavi is practically a prototype of exactly what we want for our play. He enjoys chasing loose balls and going into challenges while he transmits such great energy off and on the ball. He is a gifted footballer too. And I think, yeah, that encapsulates everything about Xavi and how good a fit he is for this Leipzig team. The way in which Xavi linked up with Šeško in the 3-0 win over Union Berlin and Openda in the 3-0 win over Augsburg would have been particularly encouraging for Marco Rosa. So when we take those young talents and we coalesce them with the mercurial Dani Olmo, the experience of Yusuf Poulsen, Emil Forsberg, and the rampaging runs down the left of David Vraum, let's not forget David Vraum, what a player he is, marauding down that left-hand side. I think what we have, yeah, is one of the most exciting attacks in the league. The numbers speak for themselves too. They've scored 13 goals in four games, which is a remarkable return. I would just caveat that whole with the fact that Leipzig have only registered 5.6 expected goals, and 10 teams can actually better that across the Bundesliga. Just thought it was worth adding that sort of asterisk in there. Maybe the goals will dry up, although I think a lot of the sort of outperformance of the expected goals can be attributed to the fact that Xavi is scoring some quite audacious goals. So, yeah, I don't think they'll be too worried about the fact that their XG figure isn't quite as high as their actual goals scored. In any event, Leipzig have been a great watch this season. They've played some beautiful football and they've scored some quite sublime goals. I would really recommend you go and watch Šeško's second goal against Union Berlin. If you haven't seen it, yeah, it's a work of art. Dani Olmo's flick through was, yeah, audacious is probably the most apt word for it. Do go and watch the build-up and the finish itself for that goal. On a closing note, Paul, let's not forget that Leipzig lost the likes of Dominic Szoboszlai, Christopher Nkunku, Konrad Leimer and Josko Gvardiol over the summer. Those are all hugely talented players, but based on the admittedly small sample size of the opening few games of the new season, they do seem to be adapting just fine to life without those key former first team players. Let's see how they get on for the rest of the season. I think they're in a good place to go on and challenge Bayern for the title. It's been a positive start. Their only defeat came against a high-flying Bayer Leverkusen side. And yeah, let's also not forget that they dismantled Bayern Munich and Germany's equivalent of the Community Shield. Okay, we're going to take a quick break now. We are going to fill up our water bottles and come back to discuss Spain. Barlow's going to chat us through all the latest goings on in La Liga. We'll be right back. Earlier in the season, we were speaking about a couple of Villarreal's players as some of the most promising youngsters in the division, the likes of Ramon Terraz and Alex Baena. A big part of their encouraging showings last season was the trust that Quique Setién had placed in them. But after just four matches, Setién became this season's first La Liga managerial casualty. It's worth remembering we are less than 18 months on from this side being in the Champions League semi-finals. What exactly has gone on here and who is the new man in charge, Barlow?
Yeah, the new man is Pacheta, who I'll come on to, and I'll explain a little bit about who he is in due course. But Unai Emery leaves, obviously, last season. And ever since, there's been kind of a bubbling undercurrent, volcanic undercurrent, if you like, leading up to this. It's not quite been a volcano in the sense that it's not blown off the top at Villarreal, but certainly there's been kind of movement of the tectonic plates. Setién is gone. And yeah, it's an interesting one because Unai Emery, it's something that we spoke about quite frequently on the podcast, that he did insane work in Europe. It was one of the very best jobs in Europe, the amount of results that he managed to get with his Villarreal squad in European football. And that was results based off Gerard Moreno, it was results based off the likes of Raul Albiol and Dani Perejo, Etienne Capoue. The real kind of veterans of the squad were really kind of taking the charge, the likes of Liverpool, Bayern Munich, those kind of sides. And they were very good. And Quique Setién comes in, and it's certainly a departure in terms of style. Setién is much more possession-based. He's much more orderly and kind of structured. And at the same time, he wants his teams to control the matches. Whereas Emery, if you look at the way he tries to control matches, it's generally without the ball and his structure without the ball that defines his kind of setup. And so already there, you've got kind of a real kind of departure. Setien's obviously, it's a very different character as well. He's much more kind of laissez-faire. He likes to let his players kind of create and move and do a little bit more off the cuff. Whereas Emery is the sort of manager that makes you work hard. He knows your exact kind of weight down to your last kind of pound and kilogram, and he knows exactly where he wants you on the pitch at all times. And so yeah, there was always kind of doubts about Setien when he came in last season. He lost kind of his opening four out of five games, I think it was. He was very close to the sack then. There's another point, kind of late February, towards mid-March, where he's also comes close to the sack after getting knocked out by Anderlecht in the Conference League. But eventually, he leads them to a fifth-place finish, and that's their best finish in about 3-4 years since they sacked Javi Calleja and brought in Unai Emery for the first time. And so yeah, it's been kind of a bit of a roller coaster ride up until then. But you look at the success that Villarreal had towards that kind of downward stretch in the end of last season. They were very good, and it was Samu Chukwueze, who's gone to Milan, Nico Jackson, who's gone to Chelsea, obviously, and Pau Torres, who's joined Unai Emery at Aston Villa. They were kind of the tenets of that side, the players that really inspired this Villarreal side to that finish, and one of their best runs in La Liga domestically for quite some time, something that Unai Emery could never quite crack. But that undercurrent of players not being quite happy, not being quite content under Setien, never really went away. And you saw it kind of briefly rear its head in about June time when Dani Parejo was linked with a move to Barcelona. It didn't come off, but one of the reasons that Parejo was supposedly open to that move was the fact that he didn't quite get on with Setien. Then pre-season goes dreadfully for Villarreal. I think they lost every game. They conceded a bunch of goals. And altogether, it was just an unhappy atmosphere. The season starts and they did lose three of their first four games. But they weren't necessarily all bad. And one of those losses, or at home to bed, that's a pretty hard fixture as it goes anyway. That can happen. And then another one was a 4-3 loss to Barcelona, where they really showed that they did have the quality to compete with them. But that international break rolls around. Fernando Rodge, clearly sensing that something is not quite right in the Villarreal camp, decides to get rid of Setien. And after he goes, loads of stories come out. So you have the Setien side of the story is coming out, saying that the players were demanding, that they wanted kind of special privileges, that they wouldn't kind of work hard for them. And you saw that Capoue was dropped at the start of the season. Parejo in his final game was also dropped. I think that was perhaps the straw that broke Fernando Rocha's belief in Quique Setien. And on the other hand, you see kind of stories that came out towards the end of the year last year, where Setien was getting people's names wrong. Reportedly, he scheduled training around his own personal kind of enjoyment. He wanted to go and play a Legends game up in Santander. And so he took training off for 2 days, gave the players 2 days off, basically so that he could go and do this and spend a week up in his home kind of region of Cantabria. So Setien's gone. I think it's mildly problematic that there is a group within the Villarreal side that is aging. That group includes Capoue, who's what, 35 now, Parejo 33, 34, Pepe Reina must be verging on 40, Albiol I think he's 37 or 38. So you have an aging group of players there at Villarreal who still run the dressing room in essence, and a group of players that really, if you're Villarreal, the way they've been run so sustainably, bringing in fresh players, new players, perhaps it wouldn't have been the right decision to keep Setien, but certainly I think it's a problem that they have a group of players that ultimately they need to phase out sooner or later. And they still have such a large hold on the dressing room, a large grip on the dressing room. And you look at their summer as well, they sold 100 million worth of players. And I thought that they had a reasonably good transfer window at the start of it, because they sold those players for good fees. They brought in a lot of players on a free, Santi Comesaña, Ben Brereton Diaz, Denis Suarez, good La Liga or kind of alternative pickups on cheap deals that they could bulk out their squad with. But I was really expecting them to go get kind of a real kind of star name or a winger that could really develop into something special. And they do have Elias Akomach, who's a youngster from Barcelona who does have potential. They signed Alexander Surlot, but we know that he's not the most clinical. So they brought in Pacheta, who it's a manager that we've spoken about again on this podcast, a manager that I really like, but it is hard not to kind of avoid the argument that he is failing upwards, in the sense that he took over Huesca halfway through the season a couple of years ago, still got relegated, even though he did a good job to get them close to safety. And then his Valladolid side, he was sacked with 7 games to go. His side were outside of the relegation zone, but they ultimately did go down as well. Pacheta is not a manager that's had this kind of job before. I mean, it's one of the big questions that was asked of him when he arrived was, how is he going to cope with European football? He's never been this high up in the table. Generally, he's been at the top of the second division or at the bottom of La Liga in the last kind of years, last few years of his career. So it's an interesting one that Pacheta's come in. He is, in a sense, the opposite of Setien. He's very kind of rara. He's very positive, very intense manager. That brings a lot of energy to the squad. And he's a really good people person, it has to be said, in terms of getting to players, in terms of connecting with people. There's few in the league better than Pacheta, I'll say that. But ultimately, he doesn't have the results to back up his track record. And that's what will come under the microscope in the coming weeks and months. Got off to a winning start, 2-1 win. Alexander Surlock got a very late header in stoppage time to give him the victory over Almeria. And very important as well, because I think it allows him to say that I'm going to lead you in the right direction. Whereas an iffy 1-1 draw at home to what's been a very poor Almeria so far would have really kind of set the cat amongst the pigeons if Villarreal had not responded. But I think it's a tough job that he's got on his hands. And those 100 million in profits, it's all very well, and it'll sanitize the club finances. But ultimately, Villarreal have been impressive and run very well recently. But because they have taken bets on players, they have invested kind of smaller fees in players that will go on and make them more money in the future. I look at this Pacheta appointment and I understand why they've made it. And I think Pacheta could do a good job. But it's a very reactionary appointment. It's an appointment that says that Rog had faith in Setien, but not enough to overcome the kind of dressing room atmosphere. It's an appointment that says that they are reacting to Setien, Pacheta, rather than going for a set type of manager. And it makes me think that if you're recruiting managers that go in different directions every time, and the manager, in this case, hasn't lasted a full year, it's problematic. And for one of the sides that we frequently praise for how well they run their business, I think it's going to be interesting to observe just how they do over the next kind of 12 months or so, and wherever they find that direction again.
Meanwhile, in Barcelona, new sporting director Deco has left Xavi with just 19 first-team players, seeing Esabde, Eric Garcia, Ansu Fati and Clement Longley all leave the club in the final 2 days of the transfer window in order to bring in João Cancelo and João Félix. Both players have their detractors and their backers, but their first appearance in Blaugrana has sparked optimism. What did we see, Barlow?
Yeah, last year of Joao Félix has definitely turned me into a detractor, but I'm willing to be proved wrong. And on Saturday night against Betis, he certainly turned up for the stars. And we saw a Barcelona that I think almost gave a cathartic performance to Montjuïc, because this is a Barcelona side that has been good in terms of being a solid side, being a well kind of organised side, a side that has won a lot of games in La Liga, but not one that's enjoyable to watch. And while you're just looking for success, you're looking to get off the poor streak in La Liga, you're looking to take the title back off Real Madrid, that's acceptable. But once you've had that success and the results are coming perhaps, but the football's still poor, it does lead you to question perhaps if Barcelona should be asked for more, as Xavi always says that Barcelona asks more of you than just results and just success. And against Betis, they finally gave them a performance that said, right, okay, we can play better football, that this is going in a direction Xavi does have an idea that he's working towards. We saw Barcelona set up in a kind of ostensibly a 4-3-3 that morphed into kind of a 5 up front with Balde on one wing, Ferran Torres on the other, Lewandowski through the middle, and then kind of one of João Félix plus another of the midfielders helping out. And it was a really good performance, it has to be said. It was a depleted Betis side, one that was missing quite a lot of players through injury. It was a side that struggled in defence, but you saw João Cancelo as well make a huge impact. He scored a brilliant goal, but he moved into midfield. He looked really at home in this side. and it was a side that flowed better, that played football that wasn't predictable, that played football at a decent pace, that had movement going in different directions, that surprised the defence. And it's just been so long since we kind of seen that from Barcelona. The Supercopa was always kind of totem pole that was held up by Xavi and said, this is what we want, this is what we're working towards. But that victory was achieved with a four-man midfield. It was achieved with Gavi playing as an auxiliary forward off that kind of front three of Lewandowski and Dembélé. Dembélé is no longer here. Lewandowski has perhaps lost a bit of importance at Barcelona in recent weeks and months. And Gavi, the question is, having put in a brilliant performance against Betis in midfield, should he be used further forward when you have the likes of João Félix there? And he made a big difference, it has to be said. And he wasn't necessarily perfect. He missed passes. He failed to get past his defender and made a couple of wrong decisions. But on the flip side of that, he knew exactly where he needed to be in order to support Lewandowski, in order to give Lewandowski a distraction, or give the defence a distraction from Lewandowski, someone to play with Lewandowski. And it was his dummy that sent the Polish striker in for a goal in this match. And now Xavi's got a decision, because he's got a lot of very good midfielders. He's got 5-6 good midfielders that, when all fit, you'd say at least four of them probably should be starting. He's got a front line that has Lewandowski, who will always start, plus Rafinha, Lamine Yamal, Ferran Torres, who's in brilliant form now, and João Félix, who's come in as this kind of star addition, looked really at home in his first start, and has managed to work out the spacing of this Barcelona attack for the first time in a very long time. What direction are this Barcelona side going? I'm not quite sure, but Xavi now at least has options. He has a chance to go in a different direction, a chance to make this a Barcelona side that's enjoyable to watch. But now perhaps this is the new era, as their Amazon Prime documentary declares so boldly. And it'll be fascinating to watch to see if João Félix finally can make that leap that we've been told he does have in him.
Absolutely, Barlow. It seems like new eras are omnipresent these days, but hey-ho. Yeah, interesting to see how João Cancelo and João Félix do fare for Barcelona, two players who, as you say, have had their detractors and their backers. Yeah, very interesting start to life for them in Catalonia. Okay, I think we will wrap up our Spanish coverage there. We're going to take a quick break before turning our attention to France. We're going to put Lyon under the Road to Nowhere microscope. We'll be right back. Sweet.
In France, Lyon parted company with Laurent Blanc earlier this month, with the club sitting bottom of Ligue 1 after four match days. Blanc lasted less than a year in the Groupama Stadium dugout and averaged just 1.53 points per game. Only one permanent Lyon manager has fared worse in the last quarter of a century, for context. So where did it go wrong for Blanc, Ali, and where did Lyon as a club go from here?
Yeah, Michael, there's a lot to dissect in terms of Blanc's 11 months or so in charge of Lyon, but before we do so, I think there is value in taking the customary Road to Nowhere step back and looking at the wider picture at the Groupama Stadium. Now, to put it lightly, the manager's job at Lyon is a bit of a poison chalice. Ostensibly, you would think that Lyon would be a great club to manage when we take into account the club's prolonged success in the early 21st century, the fantastic stadium, the fact that the city of Lyon is a beautiful place to live. But in reality, I think it's quite telling that Graham Potter, Christophe Galtier and Ole Glasner all reportedly turned down the chance to take over from Laurent Blanc. Now, the club have gone through an average of one manager a year since 2019, with that lack of continuity, I suppose, being set against the backdrop of a rather acrimonious changing of the guard upstairs too. So last season, the outspoken Jean-Michel Aulas sold the club to John Textor's Eagle Football, and Aulas had, of course, been the club's president for more than 30 years, and the club is clearly very close to his heart. However, the transition from Aulas to Textor has been undermined by a very public feud, shall we say, between the two men. So last month, Aulas threatened to sue Textor for defamation following comments that the latter had made in a press conference. Aulas then obtained a court order to freeze 14.5 million euros currently in Lyon's accounts in order to recoup sums that Oras claimed had not been paid to him by John Textor and Eagle Football. So it's all been very messy, very publicly messy, and so much so that the Lyon Ultras actually unveiled a banner before their game with PSG saying that, quote, "it's high time that football becomes a priority at Olympique Lyonnais," unquote. So I'll take the advice of those Lyon fans and I'll circle back to the football. Where did it go wrong for Laurent Blanc? Quite simply, Michael, the 57-year-old would appear to be past his managerial sell-by date. And I know that sounds rather cruel, but sometimes you have to be cruel to be kind. And to be fair to Blanc, I'll try and be fair to him, between his first game in charge and the end of last season, only three clubs picked up more points in the league than Lyon. So I suppose on the one hand, we have to give him credit for that. But on the other hand, I think that statistic simply papered over the rather obvious cracks. And those cracks developed quite rapidly into chasms at the start of the current season. Now, as you say, Michael, they sat bottom of the table after four match days. And that league position in itself was alarming enough. But the actual performances were probably even more concerning. They were woeful against Strasbourg. They were woeful against Montpellier. And they were, just totally terrible against PSG, and that did serve as the final nail in the coffin. You probably have seen, Michael, the humiliating footage of the club's ultras lecturing the players after that defeat, and it felt like a group of school pupils being told off by their teachers. Really not great optics at all. Admittedly, Lyon did lose some big names over the last year or so, the likes of Bradley Barcola, Castillo Luqueba, Houssem Aouar, Moussa Dembélé. They all left for pastures new, and they really have not been adequately replaced. And over the summer, the club brought in more than 100 million euros in transfer fees, but they then spent less than a fifth of that on new arrivals. So in that respect, Blanc has not been dealt a great hand. And we think as well, last season they weren't great. If you lose all of that talent, you lose over 100 million euros worth of talent, and you replace it with, well, risky moves in a sense, because you are, I don't like this phrase, but you are speculating to accumulate. And yeah, it's really no surprise that they've had this terrible start to the season. So yeah, on the one hand, as I was saying, Blanc hadn't been dealt a great hand. But that said, I think he does still have to take at least some responsibility for the club's lack of progress, the club's regression, you might even say, of late. Now, Adam White wrote a good piece for The Guardian on Blanc's shortcomings at Lyon, and Beth Lim wrote an in-depth tactical piece on the club's poor start to the season for Total Football Analysis. Le Classique also posted an insightful thread on X looking at Blanc's managerial career more generally. So do go and check those out if you're looking for some further reading. The key point for me, Michael, was Blanc's failure to move with the times and adapt to a much changed Ligue 1. Looking back quite a few years now, Blanc was brilliant at Bordeaux, guiding the team to the Ligue 1 title and Coupe de la Ligue glory, all whilst his team played some really beautiful football and reached, let's not forget, the quarterfinals of the Champions League. He then did a reasonable job tidying up the post-Dominic mess with the French national team before a highly successful spell with PSG. And I suppose with the passage of time and what has since happened at the Parc des Princes, what he did at PSG, becomes all the more impressive. Since leaving PSG in 2016, however, he had done very little of note before Lyon appointed him in October last year. And that appointment did feel like a risk of sorts. Perhaps the nostalgia blurred the club's judgment. I don't know. Anyway, as we now know, Blanc failed to revive his managerial career at the Groupama Stadium, instead earning himself this reputation as a tactical dinosaur of sorts. And I think Adam White summarised quite perfectly where it went wrong for Blanc in his Guardian column. So Ligue 1 changed drastically in the six or so years between the end of Blanc's time in charge of PSG in 2016 and his appointment at Lyon in 2022. The tactical landscape has evolved significantly. The division is now dynamic, innovative, with several forward-thinking managers, a far cry from the physical, pragmatic, almost conservative style that characterised the league before Blanc left PSG in 2016. Now, Blanc seemed unwilling to accept that and to adapt his style accordingly, and that stubbornness, that dogmatism, if you like, that really proved to be his undoing. So what next for Lyon? Well, on Sunday, the club confirmed that former Italy defender Fabio Grosso had been appointed as Blanc's successor. Now, Grosso is, of course, the author of arguably one of the most magical World Cup moments in recent memory, with that late, late goal against the host Germany in the semi-final back in 2006. And for that iconic moment alone, yeah, I actually really hope Grosso proves to be a success, proves to be a hit at the Groupama Stadium. He played for Lyon between 2007 and 2009, for what that's worth. So there is already a link between manager and club. In terms of his managerial career, he was involved with the youth setup at Juventus for 3 or 4 years before the spells in charge at Bari, Hellas Verona, Brescia and Sion. He then guided Frosinone to the Serie B title in May, but he left the club over the summer. Now, I'm conscious that I've maybe stolen your thunder somewhat there, Michael, but I am just keen to hear your thoughts more generally on Grosso. He's obviously caught the eye with his success at Frosinone, but what, briefly, can Lyon fans expect from their new manager?
I must admit, I mean, I've not seen his teams play an awful lot, but, you know, having been aware of the work he's done at Frosinone in particular, I think it's quite an exciting but extremely risky appointment. Frosinone left at the end of last season after guiding to promotion, and he made the decision to step down. He did it by text, although, you know, as somebody may end a relationship in that sense, and, you know, that would leave a very sour taste. Maurizio Stirpe, the president for Frosinone, was still very complimentary, even though Grosso apparently gave him no reasons as to why it was his departure. May lead you to think that although he was linked, I think, with the Sampdoria job, maybe there was also word that the Lyon job may come up in a few games' time if Blanc wasn't able to make a good start to the season. And, you know, he certainly didn't do that. But in terms of what to expect, I think we'd expect a sort of 4-3-3, Frosinone generally played with that under Grosso, especially in the promotion year, that it would actually revert to a 5-3-2 a couple of times, both times successful, as well in games that they won, I think, over the winter period last season. But yeah, he's been sacked from all those previous jobs, which you've said. Brescia only lasted 3 games, and that's his only top flight, top five league experience in Europe. If you look aside from his spell at Sion, also top flight experience in Switzerland, which didn't really go hugely to plan. But what he has shown is that in his time in the town, Frosinone, which is just by Rome, that he looks like with time, he can build a real unit. He built a team that was generally off the back of a lot of young players. I think they had 13 players on loan. Obviously something you can't do in most European leagues. Last season when his team got promoted, and then 2 players were signed for a combine of €1.5 million. And with the players that came up, he did a lot of good work with really young players as well. So maybe that's something that they've seen, for this is something where, you know, we've seen Bacola leave, obviously, but Lyon does have a lot of exciting young players, and Gusto leave recently as well. But I think that's a really exciting element of it as well. Raul Moro, a player on loan from Lazio, did particularly well. And their goalkeeper was just 20 years old, but was one of the best goalkeepers in the division, a division that also had Gianluigi Buffon in last season, who I think is 26 years his senior, I think. So, yeah, overall, I think, you know, it seemed to be either him or Gattuso. And, you know, going by Gattuso's stint at Valencia, which a team that seemed in a similarly precarious position, may be a bit worse off than Lyon, I think it's safe to say at this moment right now, even though their perilous position as this season started. Certainly seems a bit of a riskier appointment, but I think with maybe a much higher ceiling. So yeah, Grosso, like I said, that moment where he's running around shouting in Italian, I don't believe it, both when he scored, I think, in the semi-final and when he scored the penalty in the final. I mean, wouldn't it be just fantastic if there's a few more miraculous moments with Grosso and Lyon to come?
Yeah, Michael, I think we could all get on board with some Grosso iconography at the Groupama Stadium. Yeah, let's hope he hits the ground running, because Lyon are in an almighty mess, quite simply. Over the next month or so, Lyon travel to Brest and Reims before hosting Royan and Clermont-Foot. Now, I'm not suggesting that those are easy games at all, far from it, but they do represent a decent enough opportunity for the club to stop the metaphorical rot. So with Grosso coming in with fresh ideas, with fresh enthusiasm, maybe we'll see the club start to pick up points and move up the table. Definitely one to follow as the season develops. Okay, we're going to draw the French section to a close there. We're going to turn our attention now to Serie A. We'll be right back. The Derby della Madonnina sent shockwaves across European football when Internazionale registered an emphatic 5-1 win over AC Milan, a result inspired in large part by the brilliance of Henrik Mkhitaryan and Marcus Thuram. The two players joined the club as free agents, a trademark move of the Nerazzurri CEO Giuseppe Marotta, with which he helped build a dynasty at Juventus in the not-too-distant past. The early signs suggest that Simone Inzaghi's Inter side will be the team to beat in Italy's top flight this season. Can anybody stop them, Michael?
Yeah, to be honest, I'm not sure anybody can. And, you know, it would be easy enough to go off that game. I think when we did go into the derby, looking at it before the international break, Inter Milan were clear favourites. It wasn't just this performance where they've absolutely battered a team, you know, expected to compete near the top of the table. In Italy this season, they also really comfortably dismantled Fiorentina. And should be said that Fiorentina themselves have been rather exceptional starting Serie A this season. They've just come off the back. They've responded to that heavy defeat by defeating Atalanta, another team that has started okay 3-2. But Inter Milan just seem to look streets ahead of the rest of the teams at the moment. And yeah, it's really funny that you mentioned those three signings. Marcus Thuram, the standout one this summer, and he has just been absolutely sensational since arriving at the Giuseppe Meazza. And he seems to have a bit of what Romelu Lukaku does in terms of his link-up play, in terms of his sort of predatory finishing in the box. But, you know, he seems to be at a stage in his career with what's left to achieve in his career where he's just got that sheer hunger, but also, okay, maybe he's not the sort of complete number nine in the sense Lukaku is, but he's such a more well-rounded forward. He can seem to just thrive off any side. And him and Lautaro Martinez have already combined for 7 league goals. It's only Mbappe and trying to think of the other striker off the top of my head. Who would it be with Mbappe? But Haaland and Alvarez, who have got more goals together in Europe this season. I think there's, to be fair, there's a couple of it. I think Vlahovic and Chiesa are also on 7 goals, as Thuram and Martinez are, and so are Kane and Leroy Sané, but still joint second, impressive as it comes. And yeah, Marcus Thuram, he was instrumental in the first goal, where he sort of bullies his way through. I think it was past Thiaw, and then Henrik Mkhitaryan came in to score the opening goal, and then Marcus Thuram's goal for the Inter Milan's second is just absolutely outstanding. He's wrestled again and used his footwork to create some space on the left-hand corner of the box before whipping a venomous strike with both curl and power past his compatriot Mike Maignan. And yeah, he was just absolutely outstanding, as he was against Fiorentina, where he got a goal, assist, and won a penalty as well. And this whole sort of, yeah, Beppe Marotta, like you said, free agent thing, is something we became very accustomed to in the last decade with Juventus, not just with Paul Pogba, but there was a number of examples of free agents. Emre Can, you know, the list really does go on. In Adrian Rabiot, not obviously all had mixed success, but they were just a few of the players who sort of stick out to the top of my head. And it's easy to actually not acknowledge just how much this has been implemented at Inter Milan. You know, 4 of the goals scored in this game, you know, 2 from Henrik Mkhitaryan, who seems to have maybe playing the best football he's played at club level since his days at Borussia Dortmund, which led to that move to Manchester United. Hakan Çalhanoğlu, a free signing from AC Milan, just to rub salt in the wound. But then, you know, Stefan De Vrij has been an instrumental part to Inter Milan's team this season, following the departure from Milan Skriniar. And, you know, other free signings that have come this summer, Juan Cuadrado and David Klaassen, and Alexis Sanchez, who, you know, brilliantly, they've signed twice as a free agent under Marotta, you know, and it was sandwiched between a spell at Marseille that I'm sure you're very familiar with, where I think they got a bit of money for at the time as well. And, you know, you only have to look at Andrea Nana and the money that he got for him when he went to Manchester United. to see the impact it is. So, you know, what these signings have given them is not just sort of star quality in the first team, like we've seen with Mkhitaryan, Thuram and Calhanoglu, especially so far this campaign, but they've now got, you know, tremendous depth. And, you know, they've not just got the depth to, they managed to get to the Champions League final, whether to what extent that had, that detrimented their club form, it's a bit of a difficult question because they were, you know, struggling by the time they reached the knockouts, but they managed to secure top four last season, despite having this, you know, very intense run in Europe where obviously they had to beat their rivals AC Milan to get to the final. But then we're also a team of resilience. Simone Inzaghi survived difficult spells in his past two seasons where he's overcome odds. The team have, you know, won cups. Coppa Italia, they got to the name at the moment, and I think if you look at the Champions League draw, obviously we'll have to see by the time this podcast comes out, they'll have already played a game, but they've got, I think, what if you compare to last season's group, at least when they had Bayern Munich and Barcelona, it's a favourable Champions League draw, you know, the likes of Red Bull Salzburg, Real Sociedad, they're certainly not easy teams by any means, but I think it's fair to say that Inter Milan, as the Champions League finalists, do go into all of their group games as favourites this season. So if they are able to balance the Champions League, which I think they will be looking to go far in, despite their sort of comparable spending being quite low to other teams, you know, Davide Fratesi was a guy who scored the fifth goal. He's signed for 6 million with a loan option at the end of that from Sassuolo. We talked about the importance for the Neroverdi to replace him on our last podcast. They've got so many options across the team now. And yeah, I think it's just going to be fascinating to see if anyone can even live with them. I think the only team at the moment, I think that may be the case, is with Juventus, who have really maybe surprised everyone by how well they've started. They're on 10 points. Inter Milan have got 100% record in all competitions so far. And, you know, it may be over by the time this podcast comes out, but in the league, I think it's going to, you know, take a major slip up for them to lose any momentum for the time being.
In our last episode, we discussed Napoli's struggles under new boss Rudy Garcia. On match day four, the reigning champions were able to snatch a point from the jaws of defeat away to newly promoted Genoa after going 2-0 down. Now, actually on Genoa, it has been a mixed start for Alberto Giardino's side, who have picked up 4 points in as many games. Interestingly enough, the club's ownership group, 7-7 Partners, have agreed to buy Everton. So how would we assess the group's time in charge of Irosoblu, and looking ahead, what can we expect from Genoa this season?
Yeah, in terms of the owners, mixed. They've had a relegation and a promotion to the name, but I'd say, you know, if you compare where Genoa are to where 7-7 Partners even have bought them, I'd say Genoa probably in a bit of a stronger place, and they've got Alberto Gilardino at the helm. A manager who I'm delighted to see, you know, managing in Italy. He was a guy who, when I was about 8 or 9 years old, I used to play the Gilardino game with my friend. He'd just try and score goals past each other. There wasn't really much about it being, I think we just used to pretend to be called Gilardino, and it must have been something about the sort of blonde highlights he had in his hair at the time or something. And it was a bit of an icon, I think, for AC Milan on Pro Evo as well, back in the mid-noughties. But going back to sort of the current day anyway, and yeah, great. Gilardino, very similar to sort of Fabio Grosso, has found his home at Genoa. And, you know, there's definitely a case in Italy where, you know, I think people have talked about the likes of sort of Steven Gerrard, Frank Lampard in particular, former England internationals maybe walking into jobs that they maybe didn't quite deserve to get on merit, and getting chance after chance after chance. And Gilardino, he had been sacked from Serie C with Siena before getting the Genoa job. But in fairness to him, he was able to, you know, build, albeit with quite a generous budget. And what was important to stress is they did spend quite a bit the season and went down on young players as well into an exciting team that got promoted from Serie B last season. They came second to Frosinone, who were led by Grosso. And Grosso just actually took over from Alessandro Nesta here, just to give a bit more context to that sort of former players argument. But Yeah, I think it's safe to say the time's mixed. They've had to adopt a very different approach. They're a very possession-heavy team last season in Serie B. Seem to be, you know, very much that they want to sort of play off this kind of sort of purist angle a little bit in terms of, you know, the type of players they want to attract, you know, exciting young players and then play an exciting brand of football. So if, you know, that's something Everton fans, you know, and they're not quite getting at the moment with Sean Dyche, that's something that may change a little bit in the future. But they have been quite pragmatic since their return. They've been very clinical, 4 points, 4 goals, in four games. And, you know, the team that averaged the most possession last season, they've averaged the least in Serie A this season. I think it's been about 33%. And they have outperformed their XG by 2. They've got the lowest XG in Serie A, actually. So despite the start, there is maybe a sense that this Genoa team will be tested a little bit more, but their scouting system does seem to have aided them in that regard. You know, Matteo Retegui, player who came to the fore a little bit last season as he was Argentinian born in Italy international, has signed for them this summer, and he scored 2 goals, you know, good goals as well, against scoring most recently in that draw against Napoli at the weekend. So yeah, I think there's reasons to be optimistic about Genoa. I think there's a few maybe poorer teams. We've seen Empoli yet to get a point so far this season, but their priority will certainly be staying up, and you suspect that will be the same for Everton, you know, with their stadium change and two teams in transition at the moment. And it'll be interesting to see whether Genoa continue to sort of have that prioritised investment as they've done maybe in the last year or two. You know, it's a big club model. There's Hertha Berlin, Vasco da Gama, quite a few other teams involved as well. But where Genoa sort of sit will be an interesting one to look at also. But yeah, from what I've seen so far, quite excited to see how they get on. And they seem to be capable of causing an upset, having defeated Lazio 1-0 also.
Good stuff, Michael. Yeah, definitely one for us to follow. And Giardino, yeah, one of those players who perhaps through the lens of nostalgia, a throwback to the halcyon days of being a wee guy, yeah, definitely holds a certain air. Okay, well, Hellas Verona and Bologna have made bright starts to the new campaign, buoyed by the Scottish duo of Josh Doig and Lewis Ferguson, respectively. The pair actually came face-to-face on Monday evening as the two teams played out a 0-0 stalemate. After fine first campaigns on Italian ground, what can we expect from Doig and Ferguson this time around, Michael?
Yeah, I think this could be two really big campaigns for them. I would just know it wasn't maybe the best game to catch your eye, in the sense of, you know, neither of them really had too many stand-up moments. Josh Doig actually went off after just around 35 minutes, quite early in the first half. And Lewis Ferguson has had more prolific games, it's safe to say, both last season than this. He really kind of caught the headlines, Ferguson, in a 1-1 draw versus Juventus on the second match day. We said Juventus have only dropped 2 points. It was in that game versus Bologna they did so, with a great finish, and he could have scored another. And Juventus, I think it was Danilo or Bremer, kicked him in the head at one point early on in the game as well. So that could have been a red card. He was causing Juventus all sorts of problems. And what is really interesting is, you know, he's Thiago Motta is a coach who we talked a lot about on the podcast. And there was a part of me that hoped him, Grosso and Gilardino had all played together. I know Gilardino and Grosso were part of that 2006 winning squad, but Motta didn't make his Italy debut until 2011. Although I do think Motta and Grosso may play together briefly at Inter Milan. But yeah, getting back sort of off that tangent, Thiago Motta building this really exciting young team at Bologna. And, you know, it's following the departures of the likes of Roberto Soriano, Marco Arnautovic, Nicola Sansone, three players who have been, you know, regulars in Bologna's team over the past few seasons. They've brought in a host of young players, and Lewis Ferguson at the moment seems to be at the heart of that team, sort of playing in that number 10, very free roaming role, where he's linked very well with Joshua Zirkzee, a player whose career had really sort of varied in success after, you know, being at Bayern Munich when he was quite young as well. But those two, especially in the Juventus game, linked up really nicely, and they've showed good signs so far. And around Lewis Ferguson, he's also got exciting players. Jesper Karlsson, he's arrived from AZ Alkmaar on the left. We've seen Dan Endoy on the right. And Alexis Salamakers has also recently arrived from AC Milan. And if you could ask to put your young players into an environment, and if you had to choose a team in Italy right now, and you may be considered the level Lewis Ferguson's at, you've got to remember he's not a guy who's currently starting for the Scottish national team either. And, you know, although he started to score goals quite regularly, I think he hit double figures in Scotland the season before joining, and he scored 7 goals in his first season in Serie A, which is, you know, an outstanding achievement, you know, making that transition from Scottish football to Italian football as well. I don't think he could be in a better environment or with a better manager to achieve those goals. And, you know, seeing the sort of young players around and the ones we've mentioned, like Xerxes, Carlsen, Victor Chris, it seems to be a place where loads of young players want to go. Victor Christiansen's joined on loan from Leicester City, Alexis Salamakers from AC Milan, but then, yeah, just a host of sort of talented young players, and you do expect them to be pushing for that top half of the table as well. Just a quick word on Hellas Verona, as I did ask about Josh Doig. Doig's had a bit of a mixed sort of few months with Marco Baroni, the man who ultimately steered Hellas Verona quite miraculously away to safety, as we discussed on the podcast last campaign. It was that relegation playoff versus Spezia in which they survived. But one of the encouraging things is, you know, that Hellas Verona would have actually gone, I think it was third in Serie A had they won this game on Monday. They made a fantastic start to life in Serie A. But Josh Doig certainly last season had fallen out of favour a bit. He got himself back in the reckoning today, but have to understand a little bit more as to the nature of the knock that or the reason why he was substituted to see sort of what his longer term ambitions are. But I think what is clear is both when Baroni started in the job and when he started this season, he has pursued with Doig. He's also had him on set pieces at times, and there seems to be a clear willingness from the manager, even though he may have sort of long-term doubts about short-term doubts about Josh Doig's sort of suitability for, you know, in certain match situations. Long-term, it seems like he's going to persist with him. And you've got to say that both players seem in quite good hands. And for Lewis Ferguson in particular, you do kind of wonder, I'd like to see them both spend at least, Ferguson in particular, another 2 seasons at Bologna. But if Thiago Motta's to leave soon, you wonder if Ferguson may follow him or make him move elsewhere.
Lovely stuff, Michael, and I'm sure our Scottish-based listeners will appreciate the update on both Lewis Ferguson and Josh Doig, and our listeners from other parts of the globe. Okay, well, I think that's the perfect point at which to bring the episode to an end. It's been another, highly enjoyable episode to record. Hopefully for you, the listener, it's been enjoyable and enlightening in equal measure. I'll thank Michael Jones. I'll thank Rudy Barlow. I'll thank you, the listener. Until next time, stay safe. Goodbye.